Welcome back to Introduction to International Relations. The focus of this optional lecture is on human rights. As you can see from the first slide, I'm going to begin by discussing the controversial nature of human rights, and then I'll turn to the impact of international politics on human rights practices. While transnational advocacy networks, by which I mean groups of people acting alone and in concert to improve the lives of others, have become much more prominent in international relations, some allege that they have not met with much success. I'm going to try to convince you that critics are too quick to dismiss their efforts, overlooking some meaningful accomplishments. We'll review some evidence that the international community can discourage violations by tying economic benefits to improve practices, and discuss how some of the theoretical arguments you've already seen in this module can be adapted to explain the effectiveness of mere words on a page or delivered in a speech. As I said, though, we're going to start with the controversy surrounding human rights. The global push for greater respect for human rights has its origins in World War II and the horrors of the Holocaust. In 1948, the newly established United Nations adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Though 8 countries abstained, there were no votes against. If you're wondering, those 8 were the Soviet Union, Ukraine, Belarus, Yugoslavia, Poland, Czechoslovakia, South Africa, and Saudi Arabia. Of course, 5 of those states were under Soviet influence at the time, and so we shouldn't really view their abstentions as independent. This declaration was built upon 4 pillars: dignity, liberty, equality, and brotherhood. The first 2 have their roots in the Western Enlightenment. The 3rd reflects socialist principles, and the 4th reflects the goal of decolonization. In 1966, 2 separate treaties were passed that aimed to ensure that these rights were respected: the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights was championed by the United States. The International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights was championed by the USSR. The Cold War is, of course, over, but the debate about which rights to focus on is still with us. Western countries continue to focus on civil and political rights, such as freedom of speech, the right to assemble, and due process, the right to a fair trial. Critics across the globe argue that labor rights, a guaranteed standard of living, and access to health care deserve more attention than they receive. The controversy stems in part from what many see as Western hypocrisy and even insincerity. China has at times alleged that the West is not committed to human rights at all, but merely uses the concept as a cudgel with which to beat its opponents. As evidence of this, they point to the U.S.'s unimpressive record of respect for economic rights, the unequal treatment of its citizens, and the fact that some of its closest allies are worse offenders than those the U.S. tends to criticize. Hi, Saudi Arabia. How are you? Oh, you're busy convicting a woman who was gang-raped of being out in public without her husband? Cool, I'll try back later. Of course, the Western response is that China uses the occasional blot in an imperfect but overall solid record to shield itself from criticism it knows to be valid. It seems clear to me that there's a certain amount of opportunistic behavior on both sides, and that all of the world's governments could do more than they're currently doing to improve the lives of their citizens and live up to the promises of the UNDHR. It also seems clear to me that Western countries are doing better on that front overall, though we can debate what the best measure of respect for human rights is, and how much weight it would put on the different components. If anyone is interested in the indices that are already out there, or how you might go about constructing alternatives yourself, feel free to email me. I'd be happy to talk about that. Otherwise, having noted that a wide range of things are considered human rights under international law, some of which the West tends not to focus on as much as it arguably should, I'd like to move on and discuss the extent to which human rights advocates have succeeded in improving human rights practices around the globe. In 2014, The Guardian ran an op-ed by the prominent American law professor Eric Posner, declaring the campaign for human rights a failure. I hope you'll forgive me for quoting from it at length, as I think he speaks for many and does so eloquently. Posner writes, "We live in an age in which most of the major human rights treaties, there are 9 core treaties, have been ratified by the vast majority of countries. Yet it seems that the human rights agenda has fallen on hard times. In much of the Islamic world, women lack equality, religious dissenters are persecuted, and political freedoms are curtailed. The Chinese model of development, which combines political repression and economic liberalism, has attracted numerous admirers in the developing world. Political authoritarianism has gained ground in Russia, Turkey, Hungary, and Venezuela. Backlashes against LGBT rights have taken place in countries as diverse as Russia and Nigeria. The traditional champions of human rights, Europe and the United States, have floundered. Europe has turned inward as it has struggled with a sovereign debt crisis, xenophobia towards its Muslim communities, and disillusionment with Brussels. The United States, which used torture in the years after 9/11 and continues to kill civilians with drone strikes, has lost much of its moral authority. Even age-old scourges such as slavery continue to exist. A recent report estimates that nearly 30 million people are forced against their will to work. It wasn't supposed to be like this. The truth is that human rights law has failed to accomplish its objectives. There is little evidence that human rights treaties, on the whole, have improved the well-being of people. The reason is that human rights were never as universal as people hoped, and the belief that they could be forced upon countries, as a matter of international law, was shot through with misguided assumptions from the very beginning. The human rights movement shares something in common with the hubris of development economics, which in previous decades tried and failed to alleviate poverty by imposing top-down solutions on developing countries. But where development economists have reformed their approach, the human rights movement has yet to acknowledge its failures. It is time for a reckoning. Personally, I think this criticism goes too far, and I'll soon try to convince you of that. But anyone who cares about international relations has to grapple with some of the points he raises. As I say on the third slide, the number of human rights agreements has increased dramatically over time, but standard indicators show no evidence of a decrease in abuses. Many scholars have noted that ratification of the Convention Against Torture is positively associated with the incidence of torture. Many of the world's governments offer a pretense of freedom, which was not always the norm, but hold rigged elections, leading skeptics to conclude that all we've achieved is to convince authoritarian leaders that they need to lie about what they are, not actually change. The typical response to state-led mass killings is none at all. Western governments have a long history of denouncing such brutality without lifting a finger to stop it. Even when they do act, that sometimes seems to be counterproductive. Several studies have found a positive association between the imposition of economic sanctions and various measures of repression. The critics seem to have a point. The first thing to note here is that a recent article in the leading journal of political science provided evidence that human rights practices have improved over time. It's just that the reporting of violations has as well. Standard data sets seem to tell us that things aren't getting better because they were worse than we realized in the past. If we'd picked up all the abuses we missed, we'd see that the line is indeed sloping downwards, if not as sharply as we'd like. That same article found that once we correct for such issues, the CAT no longer appears to be backfiring. Others have found that leaders who have a particularly tenuous hold on power are likely to respond violently when their rule is challenged, regardless of whether they've signed the CAT. But leaders who are more secure in office do base their decisions, in part, on whether their country is a party to that treaty. The finding with respect to sanctions is potentially driven by the fact that governments don't decide who to sanction randomly. If I told you that people who walk with a cane move slower and are more likely to fall than those who don't, would you grab your grandfather's cane the next time you see him and snap it in half? I hope not, because if so, you're a monster. The question isn't whether governments that get sanctioned tend to improve their human rights practices after the sanctions go into effect, but what would have happened absent those sanctions. That's very hard to know, as we discussed in the lecture on statistical analysis. To be clear, it's entirely possible that these governments actually wouldn't have repressed as much if they hadn't been sanctioned, that the economic turmoil caused by disruptions to the flow of trade hit the common person harder than it did anyone in government, which in turn led to stronger protests that the government then cracked down on. I don't want to rule that out, but the simple observation that repression tends to increase after sanctions are imposed can't tell us whether the sanctions were responsible for that or were simply imposed early on in a crisis that everyone knew was about to get uglier, not because anyone thought those sanctions would deter the government from resorting to torture, but because they hoped to destabilize the government's hold on power and hasten their downfall. Turn to the last slide and let's discuss some of the reasons I think advocates for human rights deserve more credit than people like Posner give them. First, the same crude statistical techniques that fail to find a negative pattern of association between the adoption of human rights agreements and the incidence of rights violations have identified such a pattern when it comes to the adoption of trade agreements with human rights prerequisites. I told you back in the lecture on international institutions that trade agreements appear to work best when they have such prerequisites because that allows blue types to be sure they aren't being tricked into opening up to imports from red types who won't reciprocate. Well, it appears those agreements also succeed in improving human rights practices. Standard caveats apply, of course. It might just be that the only states who are willing to sign these agreements are those who already had a great deal of respect for human rights. I really can't stress enough how difficult it is to know whether we've identified a causal relationship. We also have evidence of a negative association between human rights violations and loans from the World Bank and the IMF. Specifically, structural adjustment programs. Initial work on the topic found the opposite, but a later study suggests that what's happening is that governments improve their human rights practices while the loan is active, but tend to repress after it expires. Why? Well, when the term of a loan ends and it doesn't get renewed, governments often abandon the reforms they only said they'd pursue in order to qualify for a loan, which can lead to protests that are met with repression. We shouldn't criticize the World Bank or IMF for demanding reforms as a condition of receiving loans then, but instead encourage them to renew loans when governments have started down the path of reform, even if they're not making as much progress as we'd like. If the more recent study has got things right, and we can't know that for sure, these institutions have the power to improve human rights practices, though they could be doing a better job of it. Finally, another recent study found that countries with better human rights practices attract more foreign direct investment, even after we account for the fact that they also tend to have more advanced economies. I don't know that anyone would argue that multinational corporations are making their business decisions with an eye towards whether they encourage better human rights practices. but that nonetheless seems to be the effect of their very self-interested behavior. All of those arguments pertain to economic incentives. I basically just told you that various studies have found that there are costs to mistreating your people and rewards to respecting their rights. Taken together, they suggest that we can make the world a better place, at least a little, by requiring governments to commit to a greater respect for human rights before we do business with them, whether that "we" refers to actions we take through our elected governments, global financial institutions, or the corporations we patronize. Finally, let's talk about two ways in which it's possible to improve a government's human rights practices without offering tangible economic benefits. First, think back to the lecture on international institutions. There, I argued that the mere act of signing an agreement could reveal information about whether you're the blue or red type, and that this can solve trust problems and thereby facilitate cooperation that wouldn't otherwise occur. That wasn't an argument about anyone changing their type. When agreements act as reassurance mechanisms, the realist critique that the only states signing them are those who were already willing to cooperate is absolutely correct. It's just that when no one knows for sure who's willing to cooperate and who isn't, there's a lot of value in sorting that out. Agreements don't need to change anyone's willingness to cooperate as long as they reveal that willingness. When I first advanced this argument, the only examples I provided concerned economic cooperation. Well, we can apply the same logic to human rights. A recent book on the laws of war argues, rather persuasively, that violations, such as the mistreatment of prisoners, are less likely to occur when both sides have ratified the Geneva Conventions, but the same does not hold when only one side has done so. It's important to note that when only one side is committed to upholding the laws of war, that side is often just as likely to mistreat prisoners or target civilians or whatever as the one that has not done so. This tells us that it's not simply that nice countries sign and nasty ones don't. Rather, it seems that many states are only willing to respect the laws of war if they expect the other side to do so as well, suggesting that we have a trust problem. The laws of war appear to be partially effective in helping those who are willing to commit atrocities when they feel they have no choice because their opponent is fighting dirty, but are happy to refrain from doing so if their opponent fights fair, to identify one another. The more attentive amongst you will note that I argued in that lecture that for agreements to have this reassurance property, they need to have preconditions that are moderately costly, which the Geneva Conventions do not. Why might we still be willing to believe that they separate types? Well, because red types don't always want to convince the other side that they're blue in this context. When we're talking about trade, we could safely assume that they do. Everyone wants other countries to buy their stuff. Some states just don't want to have to do the same in return. However, it's not hard to find examples throughout history of one side communicating quite clearly to the other that they intend to commit every atrocity, make use of every weapon, and generally make standing against them as painful as possible. I'm not saying that once a country signs the Geneva Conventions, that guarantees that no future representative thereof would choose to violate it. Rather, I'm arguing that because some of those who intend to fight dirty make no attempt to hide that fact, whereas there's very little incentive to claim that you'll commit war crimes if in fact you'd never even contemplate doing so, it's possible to avoid tragic situations where blue type faces off against a fellow blue type, yet both commit atrocities because they're afraid the other side might do so first. and the evidence seems to bear that out. One last point before we conclude. When their rule is challenged, leaders often order the military and/or the police to crack down on the people challenging it. We'll talk more about when protests are likely to succeed and what governments do to prevent that from happening later in the module. In some cases, these representatives of the state are reluctant to carry out those orders. Even in authoritarian regimes, many of those in uniform see themselves as serving the interests of society at large by ensuring order and defending against threats. When asked to defend the leader against a threat to their rule that comes from the very people they see themselves as ultimately serving, many feel conflicted. However, refusing to obey a direct order can have pretty serious consequences, especially if the leader remains in office. So those who've been told to crack down on the protests may face a coordination problem. The majority of them might prefer to disobey the order, provided that everyone else is disobeying it as well, yet nonetheless be willing to follow it if they're afraid that everyone else is going to do the same. This is similar, in a sense, to our discussion of students at Essex deciding whether to go to Top Bar or Sub-Zero, but the stakes are just a little bit higher. Absent any sort of intervention from the rest of the world, it's likely to play out the same way too. Using very similar cut points and probabilities, we could talk about when each outcome would occur, but everything from no response to the protests, because the government's forces refused to carry out their orders, to a complete massacre would be possible. We might expect those cut points to look a bit different, because we might specify the payoffs using things other than betas, but there's no real need to do so. If you understood our discussion of that model, you'll understand the argument I'm about to make. Suppose that the international community calls on the leader to step down, warning that any violent response will not be tolerated. It's possible that this is a bluff, of course. When push comes to shove, Western governments have often decided that it's better to maintain a working relationship with a brutal dictator who at least shares some of their interests in the region, than to sever ties in order to make a statement about the way they treat their own people. That's not the point, though. Even if the leader isn't fazed by such comments and still orders a crackdown, it's more likely that the security forces refuse to carry it out. As you saw in one of our in-class activities, sometimes all it takes is someone shouting out, "Red triangle!" to solve a coordination problem. Nothing compelled you all to write that answer down, just as statements from the international community don't prevent anyone from following their orders. But in coordination games, it matters a great deal what you expect everyone else to do, and mere words can influence that.